Hello, my name is Tony Reid. Welcome to GAY, a radio programme for LGBTI people and their friends on Coast Access Radio 104.7 FM and other access radio stations around New Zealand. This month we have another reading, and it was just due to be a reading from of another chapter from Closet Queens, which I used a couple of months ago for Tom and Bob. And this month I am doing the chapter Casualties of War, about some of the young gay MPs who fought for Britain. But then I realised that, of course, there had been a full book about this. So although I'll be primarily reading from the Closet Queens chapter, I will refer also to the book, which is called The Glamour Boys, The Secret Story of the Rebels Who Fought for Britain to Defeat Hitler. And it's by Chris Bryant, who is a gay Labour MP and writes quite a lot. And he has written on this whole topic in a lot more detail. So we'll at least start off with his commentary. If you look carefully behind the Speaker's chair in the House of Commons, just underneath the press gallery, there is a row of 23 shields, each of them about 5 inches high. Some have letters surrounded by laurels painted in gold on a blue background. Each shield commemorates an MP who lost his life in active service in the Second World War, but you will probably never have heard of them. You will almost certainly not know that at least 4 of the men were queer or nearly queer, that is to say gay, bisexual or somewhere in between, and that they had shown as much courage personally and politically before the war as they did during it, defying convention and the party managers in Parliament. The whips with remarkable sang-froid. Most families, biographers and historians deliberately excised any hint of their sexuality from such accounts of their lives as do exist, and virtually wiped them from the history books. Even recent historians have seen these men's shared sexuality as an irrelevance. This, then, is their true unexpurgated story, a story of unsung bravery at a defining moment in Britain's history. Their sexuality was an essential aspect of their bravery because they had been schooled and encouraged by a society that hated homosexuality. This is not a simple story. Although 4 of them were killed in action, these men were not always heroic. They were often deeply conflicted. They were never part of a gay rights movement, and they would be amazed at the freedoms enjoyed today. If anything, they reckoned that men like them simply had to make the best of a bad lot. They would probably have hated to be identified as homosexual, queer or gay. And yet I hope they have been as proud of this book as we should be of them. Because as one of them put it in 1943, this is part and parcel of the battle we are fighting. The battle for justice, liberty and toleration. What Chris Bryant's book fails to mention is that there was this chapter in Closet Queens, which was published about 5 years earlier, and it's not even in his very extensive bibliography, which is intriguing. But I will read some sections of chapter 9, Casualties of War. The previous chapter had dealt with Harold Nicholson, who we've talked about before, a famous gay diplomat married to a famous lesbian, one of the most famous lavender marriages of the century, the famous lesbian Vita Sackville-West, girlfriend of Virginia Woolf, and the dedicatee of Orlando, Woolf's transgender novel from 1928. Harold was also an MP from 1935 to 45 and a supporter of the national government, as all these people were. So he was well placed to coordinate, as it were. His and Vita's name have, of course, lived on in the house and garden they created at Sissinghurst in Kent, which is now a major National Trust site. Harold Nicholson's friends included 4 young MPs who shared his homosexual tastes, all of whom died on actual service during the Second World War: Victor Cazalet, Rob Bernays, Jack McNamara and Ronnie Cartland. As MPs, they were not obliged to serve in the armed forces, but they all considered it their patriotic duty to do so. They were also, like Nicholson himself, all profoundly unhappy with the appeasement policy of the Chamberlain government. Cartland and McNamara joined Nicholson in abstaining in the parliamentary vote on the Munich Agreement in October 1938, attracting the ire of the whips. while Bernays came close to resigning as a junior minister over it. For following the betrayal of the Czechs, Cazalet dedicated himself to the cause of Hitler's next victims, the Poles. Victor Cazalet, 1896 to 1943, was a neighbour of Harold and Vita in Kent. The son of a wealthy mercantile family of Huguenot descent, well-connected, he was a godson of Queen Victoria, accomplished both as an all-round sportsman and an amateur pianist, debonair, and handsome, if rather short, hence his nickname Teeny, awarded the MC for his heroic exploits on the Western Front. He captured Chippenham for the Conservatives in 1924, aged 27, and held the seat until his death almost 20 years later. He was a rather saintly man, having become an ardent Christian Scientist at Eton. He tended to give everyone the benefit of the doubt, rarely spoke ill of anyone, and was happy for others to take credit for his achievements. Though he was far from stupid, he narrowly missed getting a first at Oxford, and his diaries show literary talent. His virtuous outlook won him the reputation of being naive in his judgments, and while popular with leading figures in all the political parties, he never acquired any office beyond that of parliamentary private secretary. He did, however, do much to advance various causes in which he believed, including Zionism and the Polish cause, before and during the Second World War. On becoming premier in 1940, Churchill, who had admired Cazalet as a young man, offered him no job in his administration, but made him the liaison officer between the Polish leader General Ladislav Sikorski and the British government. For 3 years, Cazalet won general admiration for his handling of this role, which included smoothing over disagreements among the Poles, as well as helping conduct their often difficult relations with their allies, until he perished with Sikorski on 4th of July 1943, when the aircraft in which they had just taken off from Gibraltar crashed into the Mediterranean. A mysterious accident, which coming as it did just did a few weeks after the Germans had announced the discovery of the mass grave at Katyn of Polish officers murdered by the Russians, has given rise to various conspiracy theories. Though Cazalet had many female admirers, he never married. The closest relationship in his life seemed to have been with his Scottish mother, whom he adulated and called his angels, and his sister Thelma, a feminist who herself was elected a Conservative MP in 1931. In her memoirs, Thelma, who reciprocated her brother's adoration, deals indignantly with insinuations concerning his sexuality. The reason Victor never married, she claims, stressing his sporting achievements, is that he dreaded becoming too engrossed with one person and too fond of his own children to bring them up properly. It is indeed possible that this otherworldly and rather puritanical man, who abstained from alcohol and tobacco and devoted much of his spare time to boys' clubs, never had sexual relations with anyone. But most of the important friendships of his life were with homosexual or bisexual men. His great friends between the war included Bob Boothby, the novelist Hugh Walpole, and the German tennis champion Gottfried von Kramm, who was sent to prison on account of his homosexuality. Harold Nicholson was an old friend, though he was often exasperated by Cazalet's enthusiasm, many of which he did not share, and took a jaundiced view of Cazalet's passion for entertaining the great. Victor's mania for knowing important people is becoming an obsession, he wrote in 1937. Were he not so mean about supplying food and drink, he would rapidly become one of London's leading hostesses. Cazalet's closest friend in the House of Commons was said to be Hamilton Kerr, the young American born Conservative MP for Oldham, another lifelong bachelor who combined sporting and artistic interests. After the war, Kerr became MP for Cambridge, in which position he was succeeded in 1966 by Robert Royd James, who a decade later would publish a biography of Cazalet, which managed, as usual, to contain nothing about the subject's private life. The son of a North London vicar, Rob Bernays, 1902-45, made his mark, despite a stammer, as president of the Oxford Union in 1925, and subsequently earned his living as a journalist with the Liberal Daily News. Having been sacked by the paper in 1930, he spent some months as private secretary to Lord Beecham and accompanied that Liberal grandee on the jaunt to Australia which preceded his downfall. Bernays later assured Nicholson that he had been appalled by Beecham's flaunting of his proclivities and had left his employment on account of it, but he kept in touch with Beecham, with whom he spent two nights in Paris in 1936 and also wrote speeches for Beecham's son. Bernays captured the seat of Bristol North from Labour at the 1931 general election and held it in 1935. Victories only made possible the fact that he faced no Conservative opponent, belonging as he did to the Liberal faction allied to the Conservatives in the national government. He rose to be a junior minister during the premiership of Neville Chamberlain. He also kept a diary published 50 years after his death and now regarded, along with Nicholson's, as an important historical source on the parliamentary politics of the period. Nicholson, 16 years his senior, first met him on entering Parliament in 1935, and they soon became close friends as non-Conservative supporters of the national government. They held similar political views. But they also seemed to have fallen in love, a passion which may have been consummated during 10 idyllic weeks they spent together on a parliamentary delegation to East Africa in the winter of 1937. In letters to Vita, Nicholson referred to my beloved Rob. In letters to his sister, Bernays wrote that he is very fond of me as I am of him, and he hoped one day to marry a woman with whom he had the kind of mental affinity that I have with H. However, when Bernays did marry in 1942, age 40, it was to someone very different to the gentle Harold. Nancy Britton, daughter of a Bristol Liberal political family, a strident character who went on to become a colonel in the ATS, the British Army Women's Branch. Like Harold and Vita, they had two sons who never knew their father, as he died in January 1945 while visiting British troops in Italy and Greece when his plane disappeared over the Adriatic. Nicholson had learned of the death of Tini with equanimity, but on hearing about Rob, he felt crushed. Jack McNamara, 1905-44, was born in Assam in northeastern India, the son of an Irish doctor employed by a tea company. He hardly knew his parents, who sent him to England at the age of three to be looked after by a succession of Saki-esque aunts. This experience seems to have made him profoundly misogynistic. In 1938, that he wrote, as much as he disliked Hitler, he admired him for having put German women in their place. You see, these weren't exactly perfect representatives of LGBT culture. After education at Cheam and Haileybury, schools specialising in the Sons of Empire, the blonde and handsome McNamara was recruited by the Secret Service, hoping to counter subversion during the turbulent period which featured the general strike of May 1926. That same year, he was briefly arrested by the French authorities in Tunisia as a British spy, though it is possible he was drawn to that country for reasons other than espionage. From 1927 to 1933, he served as a regular officer with the British Army in India, possibly a cover for continued intelligence work. He made himself unpopular with the Memsahibs by refusing to dance with their daughters, but seems to have been admired by several native princes who had him stay in their palaces. Back in England, McNamara became involved in Conservative politics. He unsuccessfully contested a by-election in East London, being opposed by local Jews who suspected him of fascist leanings. They may not have been entirely mistaken. Though later a fervent opponent of appeasement, he was for a time a member of the Anglo-German Fellowship. However, at the 1935 general election, having just turned 30, he won the contest at Chelmsford, having been adapted there on the recommendations of former Conservative MP, Colonel Charles Howard Bury, a famous soldier and explorer who was a homosexual and admirer of McNamara. McNamara seems to have been an earnest and an idealistic MP, if rather easily swayed in his views. During his first year in Parliament, he associated closely with the raffish homosexual Guy Burgess, just down from Cambridge, who acted as McNamara's assistant until he got a job as a BBC Talks producer. Though Burgess, in order to preserve his cover as a Soviet agent, a role of which McNamara almost certainly knew nothing, had resigned from the Communist Party and even followed McNamara into the Anglo-German Fellowship. But he seems to have influenced McNamara in a left-wing direction, for example, getting him to sympathise with the Republican cause and the Spanish Civil War. McNamara and Burgess visited Nazi Germany together in 1936. Burgess later boasting to his friend Gronwy Rhys that they had enjoyed themselves with the boys of the Hitler Youth. They also visited Paris to meet Burgess's friend Edward Pfeiffer, the homosexual chef de cabinet of the French politician and then war minister, later Premier Daladier, who organised erotic entertainments for them. Burgess was a lover of Harold Nicholson, and by the spring of 1936, Nicholson and McNamara were also seeing much of each other, staying up until the early hours at Nicholson's flat at King's Bench Walk. Nicholson wrote that McNamara struck him as the best of the MPs newly elected in 1935, though still requiring much experience of public affairs and public behaviour and education, to which Nicholson doubtless felt he might contribute. Whatever his earlier views on Hitler, by the time of Munich, McNamara had concluded that Nazi Germany would have to be fought. Most of his parliamentary interventions stressed the urgency with which Britain's armed forces needed to prepare for the coming struggle. On the outbreak of hostilities in 1939, he returned to full-time soldiering while remaining an MP. For 2.5 years, he commanded a territorial battalion, the 1st London Irish Rifles, based in Sussex. Nicholson several times visited him there to address the troops. McNamara, in turn, called on Nicholson whenever he was in London, usually with some young friend in tow. McNamara was a favourite of Winston Churchill, who entertained him at 10 Downing Street and chose him first to command the new Royal Air Force Regiment, designed to secure and defend airfields, when it was created in 1942, then to be Deputy Chief of Combined Operations in the latter role. McNamara masterminded such operations as the airlifting of supplies to Tito's partisans in Yugoslavia and the kidnapping by Patrick Lee Fermor of the German commander in Crete. He was killed in December 1944 by German mortar fire while revisiting his old battalion, then manning a front along the Senio River in northern Italy. Ronald, or Ronnie Cartland, 1907-40, was the younger brother of the novelist Barbara Cartland, who after his death published a biography of him in which she portrayed him as a spotless paragon. Certainly he seems to have been a young man of unusual courage, high principles and independence of mind. His grandfather was a once prosperous Birmingham industrialist who committed suicide after suffering ruin. His father then worked for the Conservative Party, hoping to become an MP, but was killed in action in 1918. After Charterhouse, where he was regarded as a model schoolboy, Cartland followed in his father's footsteps by working for the Conservatives and managed to get adopted in 1933 as their candidate in the Birmingham constituency of King's Norton, largely thanks to the patronage of Neville Chamberlain, whose family had ruled Birmingham since the 1870s. Having won his seat at the 1935 election, however, Cartland did not hesitate to attack Chamberlain, first for not doing enough as Chancellor of the Exchequer to help the poor, then as Prime Minister from May 1937 for his appeasement of Hitler. His most famous moment occurred on 2nd of August 1939 when he spoke out against Chamberlain's motion to adjourn the House for 2 months, which had been framed as a confidence motion, accusing the Prime Minister of having ideas of dictatorship and declaring prophetically, "We are in a situation that within a month we may be going to fight and we may be going to die." This was regarded as treason by Tory whips and loyalists, but made him a hero to those MPs who wanted to stand up to Hitler. When war did break out a month later, Cartland duly went off to fight in France, dying a hero's death in May 1940 with a unit which sacrificed itself in order to hold back the Germans from Dunkirk during the Allied evacuations. He had been greatly admired by Churchill, who wrote a preface to Barbara's biography, in which he eulogised him in much the same terms as he had Rupert Brooke in 1915. Cartland's closest relationships, like Cazalet's, were with his mother, a colonel's daughter, to whom he wrote constantly, addressing her as "my own darling," and his sister Barbara, whom he met daily when they were both in London, regarding her as his greatest confidant and inspiration. Otherwise, he seems to have had little interest in women, though he was extremely attractive to them. When one of his admirers, Ruth Leonard, offered to act as his unpaid secretary, he accepted her offer, but never addressed her by a Christian name, and replied to her letters by offering advice on religion. He was close to Harold Nicholson, with whom he agreed politically, and whom he seems to have regarded as a father figure. Many of his friends were homosexual, including inside the House of Commons, Alex Lennox, Boyd, Paul Latham, Jack McNamara and Philip Sassoon, and outside of it, Peter Coates, Noel Coward, and Rome Landau, a Polish-born mystic sculptor and Arabist. Although, again, like Cazalet, he was profoundly Christian and somewhat fastidious and abstemious in his habits, he does not appear to have been entirely celibate. The rest of the chapter is about another young victim called Paul Latham, whose story is very different from the other ones. And so I am leaving him and going to the epilogue to finish of Chris Bryant's book, The Glamour Boys, to finish off. Parliament Square was so packed on the afternoon of 8th May 1945 that mounted police had to keep back the crowds. Germany had declared its unconditional surrender at 2:41 the previous morning, and thousands had gathered to hear Churchill's official declaration of victory in Europe, relayed through loudspeakers, and to see the man in person. Nothing was quite normal inside Parliament either. Solemnity took hold again when the Speaker, in his full ceremonial robes, slipped past Churchill and the government's red benches and led the two houses out into Central Lobby, past the statues of Gladstone and Pitt, down the stairs of St. Stephen's Hall and out to St. Margaret's Church for a service of thanksgiving. The service inside St. Margaret's was excruciating, with all its thanksgiving to an all-powerful God. Everyone tried to sing the hymns with gusto, but sitting next to Nancy Astor, Harold Nicholson must have found it difficult to sing to the Lord with cheerful voice or burst into songs of joy, as the readings from Isaiah told him he should do. It got even worse when the Speaker's chaplain stood in front of two Union flags laid out on the altar and read out the names of the 21 MPs who had been killed in action. The list over, everyone stood for the final hymn. O God, our help in ages past. The penultimate verse was especially poignant. Time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. And it was more than many could manage to sing through to the end. They fly forgotten as a dream dies at the opening day. And then the church bells started ringing out for victory. Harold had tears in his eyes. Furtively I wiped them away, he wrote. Men are so emotional, sniffed Nancy Astor, who was sitting next to me. Damn her. Nancy Astor has not been very well served by history, as she was the leader of the Cliveden set, named after her stately home that she lived in Buckinghamshire, where she hosted lots of meetings of supporters of Neville Chamberlain and Archer Appeasement. She was one of the biggest appeasers and therefore not popular with Churchill either. As she was getting older, she was persuaded very strongly to stand down as MP for her Plymouth constituency after the war, which she did with great reluctance, but it didn't do any good because in the big swing to Labour in 1945, the seat was lost by the Conservatives to Labour in the figure of one Michael Foot. So anyway, I hope you've enjoyed those readings of a famous part of British history, but an obscure corner of it. And I do recommend reading Chris Bryant's book, The Glamour Boys, of which we've only touched the surface, really.
This program is made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.